From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Journalist Pete Early's latest book was triggered by a personal crisis, the discovery that his son had become delusional and wouldn't take medication he needed to get better. Early's book, Crazy, A Father's Search Through America's Mental Health Madness, is part memoir and part an examination of the nation's failure to treat its mentally ill, 300,000 of whom have ended up in prison. And we talk with E. Fuller Torrey, a psychiatrist who's working to change commitment laws so that courts can compel the treatment of seriously disturbed patients who don't believe they're sick. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Pete Early is a veteran journalist who's written 3 novels and 7 nonfiction books on subjects ranging from Cold War spy rings to life in Leavenworth Prison. But Early's latest book, Crazy, A Father's Search Through America's Mental Health Madness, is about his own desperate attempts to help his son who suffers from serious mental illness. Early concludes that laws enacted to protect the mentally ill from abuse and confinement to state hospitals have made it almost impossible to get treatment for those who don't believe they're sick. In his investigation, Early found that 300,000 mentally ill people are in prison. I spoke to Pete Early last week. Pete Early, welcome to Fresh Air. You took on this subject of the mentally ill in America's prisons because of a very personal experience of your own son, Michael. How did his mental illness present itself?
Well, Dave, he was a student in New York, and it's very typical, I found out, that a lot of young people in their early 20s, this will be when a mental illness first manifests itself. He was a student in New York, and I got a call from his brother saying, gee, something's wrong with Mike. I drove up there, and I found him in a completely delusional state. I convinced him to come with me, and we headed back to Washington, D.C., where I live, and I called ahead and had the hospital standing by on alert. And I went through the doors thinking, wow, I'll get help. It'll be okay. We'll be able to help him think more clearly. And it turned out that was absolutely wrong.
You said he was delusional. What was he experiencing?
Well, my son has been diagnosed in different ways. He's been diagnosed as having bipolar disorder. Another set of psychiatrists thought he might have schizoaffective disorder. And another one said it may be early stages of schizophrenia. Bipolar disorder is a mood disorder. And you see people going to highs and lows very rapidly sometimes. Schizophrenia is a thought disorder where you may see hallucinations. You may not know, as in my son's case, when you're awake or when you're asleep. And schizoaffective is kind of the link between, which you can have both mood and thought disorders. My son was doing what was called rapid cycling. He would go from being euphoric and thinking he could do anything to bursting into tears and not being able to explain why. So on this journey from New York to Washington, my son had an earlier episode, and I was trying desperately to get him to take his antipsychotic medication. He was convinced they were poisons, and he would not touch them.
What kind of conversation did you have on that long drive?
Well, at one point my son said to me, you know, no one dies unless they want to. And I said, well, did my wife's first husband die because he wanted to? And then he'd be real quiet. And then his mind was just jumping from one subject to another. He would see a bumper sticker and he'd laugh because it had some kind of secret message. And he'd say, God, dog. God, dog, get it? Meaning it could be reversed. He would be laughing one minute, talking about sex, rock and roll, rap music, and the next minute he'd start sobbing uncontrollably, telling me that he committed some horrible sin that he couldn't tell me about. It was just really heart-wrenching.
I can only imagine what that must have been like for a father to see your son in that kind of pain and disorientation. You end up at an emergency room and have a very frustrating encounter with a physician there.
Well, you know, we're trained to believe, we grow up believing that if we take someone who's ill, we get them into an emergency room, they can get help. And so, yes, it was horrible riding with him, but I clung to this hope that as soon as I got him in the emergency room, the doctors would know what to do. We got to the emergency room, and of course the nurse was rolling her eyes when she saw what kind of condition he was in, and we went into a little holding area. They isolated us from everyone else, and we proceeded to sit there, and an hour went by, and my son was reading an old New Yorker, and he just kept studying one page because God was sending him secret messages on this page. Another hour went by. A third hour went by, and after 4 hours of waiting, my son said, well, I'm leaving. And I said, wait, and I dashed out in the hall, and I flagged down a nurse, and I said, please, my son is psychotic. We've been here 4 hours. Send someone in. And the doctor came in, and it was amazing to me because he came in, and he had his hands up as if he was going to surrender, and he said, look, I'm going to tell you right now, there's nothing I can really do for your son. And I thought, you hadn't even examined him. How can you say that? And I said, well, he's been diagnosed with bipolar disorder. He's off his medications. He has a history. And he said, up to this moment, none of that matters. And I was shocked. And I said, what do you mean it doesn't matter? Would you say that to someone who, you know, has had a heart attack, or say that to someone who has cancer? And he said, no, it doesn't matter. All that matters is what he is thinking right now. And he turned to my son and he said, can you count backwards from seven in sevens? And my son started to count backwards. And he said, okay, what does the phrase, don't cry over spilt milk, mean? And my son explained it to him. And he said, if I ask you to take your medicine, will you take it? And he says, absolutely not. That's poison. He says, well, do you know who I am? And my son says, yes, you're the witch doctor. Ooh, ee, ooh, ah, ah. And they both kind of laughed. And the doctor said, are you planning on hurting yourself? And I interrupted and I said, he talked about killing himself on the way down here. He asked me, he said, Dad, what would you think if someone you loved killed himself? And the doctor immediately turned to my son and he said, are you thinking about killing yourself? And my son said, absolutely not. He said, are you thinking about killing someone else? And he said, no. He said, okay, the law says you have to be in imminent danger to yourself or others. He's not, so there's nothing I can do. And my son said, can I go? And he said, yes, absolutely. Now, I'm talking to the doctor, trying to understand why he refuses to treat my son. My son steps out. He gets into a loud argument. They call security, and I'm thinking, now, look, he can't even get out of the emergency room without getting into some kind of trouble. Surely you'll see to help him. And they said, no, you need to take him home or he'll be arrested. So I took him home. Dave, I cannot really explain to you how horrible it is to watch your child decompensate over the next 48 hours, to watch their mind go deeper and deeper into this abyss and not be able to do anything about it. It is the worst feeling for a parent.
I know that there came a point at which he ended up at the home of your ex-wife, and you said that he picked up a videotape of an Oliver Stone movie, which he was convinced held secret coded messages for him. It became so frustrating that at one point you ended up lying to a psychiatric social worker and saying that he had threatened you. What led to that?
Absolutely. What happened was, during this period when he's with me in my house, I am so desperate that I actually take medication, old medication that he had, and I'd smash it up and try to hide it in his cereal. And he sees it, and he becomes outraged, and so he demands to be taken to my ex-wife's house. The next day, he gets up early in the morning, and he goes out and walks into a Starbucks and announces that he can pick up a bottle of water and drop it and nothing will happen. And of course he drops it and it breaks. He runs out of the store. The clerk who recognized him, happened to have gone to high school with him, calls the police. So they know that they have someone who's delusional, who's in the area. Then they get a burglar alarm call. What he had done is he had felt completely dirty. He felt ashamed. So he picked up a patio chair at a stranger's house and threw it through the back patio window, gone in the house. He had turned over the pictures of the children on the mantle. He'd gotten himself some liquor out of the cabinet. And then he'd gone upstairs and drawn a bubble bath. Thankfully, the people weren't there. The police arrived. A couple days before, a psychotic person in Maryland had killed two officers. So the police in Fairfax County were worried about going in this house. So they turned a dog loose. It went in and grabbed my son in the arm, locked its jaws on him, pulled him down. It still took six officers wrestling with him to get him out. Thankfully, they did not hurt him. He thought, because he had a high sense of paranoia, he told me later that he thought they were trying to kill him. And they took him to a holding center. When I arrived there, the police called. I arrived there. Actually, a policeman was out front, and he said, Mr. Early, even though your son has broken into a house, even though your son is obviously not thinking clearly, he will not be allowed to stay at the hospital unless you go in there and tell him he's threatened you or someone else. And I said, you're kidding. And he said, I'm not kidding. He'll be taken to jail. You don't want him in jail. So I went into the holding center and told the psychiatric nurse there, I said, he's threatened to kill me. I need to have him locked up. And she said, will you sign a statement saying that? I said, absolutely. And immediately then he was taken to a hospital where he was held for 72 hours.
So it took a lie to get him treatment.
Not only did it take a lie to get him into treatment, but when I got to the hospital and I said, finally, we're going to get him help, they said, oh, no. Just because he's here doesn't mean that we're going to give him medication. He has a right, even though he is clearly psychotic, to refuse to take any medication and not take any treatment. Then I got a phone call. And of course, you know, I'd been a journalist for 30 years. I thought I understood all this, how the system works. And what I found out was I didn't know anything. I got a phone call from a public defender. And because of so many stories I've done, I've kind of always looked at public defenders as kind of the good guys who are battling, you know, to make sure one's rights are protected. And that, in fact, was what this person was doing. And I said, oh, good, you're going to call. You've called. You can help me get my son help because he needs treatment. And she said, no. My role is to defend his rights. And if he wants to be released immediately, that's what I'm going to go do. And I said, he's psychotic. He's not thinking clearly. This is my son. I love him. This isn't a case of some elderly woman who we're trying to put in a state mental hospital and take all her money. And he said, this is the law. I'm here to protect your son. Even if he's psychotic, if he wants out, I'll get him out. Fortunately, at the hearing the next day, my son, I'd met with him and persuaded him that he needed to stay in the hospital. So my son agreed to stay. That night, the doctor called and said they'd found some of the medicine on the floor, that he had cheeked it. He had put it in his mouth and then spit it out. So we didn't really know if he was going to end up taking his medication or not. I went to see him again, and I talked to him, and it happened to be my birthday, and we had a very, as you can imagine, I was in tears, he was in tears, and he told me, he said, I don't know if I'm awake or dreaming. Is any of this really happening? And I said, it is happening. And I showed him the wounds on his arm where the dog had bitten him. And he goes, I keep thinking I'm just going to wake up. This is a dream. I'm going to wake up. I'll be in my bed. I'll be back in school. And I said, it's not. You have to take your medicine. Please, please take your medicine. So he began taking his medicine. And I thought, wow, at least we've crossed this hump. You know, I can get my son back. And 3 days later, I got a call from the psychiatrist at the hospital, a very wonderful man, who said, the insurance company is insisting your son be released. He is not in imminent danger to himself or others. The law says he has to be kept in the least restrictive possible circumstances. And he's taking medication. And I said, what do you think? And he said, I think as soon as we turn him loose, he'll quit taking medication and he'll disappear. And there's a good chance you'll lose your son.
What happened as you confronted this insurance company representative about the issue?
What happened with the insurance was the doctor said, recommended, do not, if it's all possible, keep your son here. We need more time with him. And I called the insurance company, and the person was very polite but very firm and said, we will not continue to pay your son's bill. And at that point, I committed another ethical violation. Not only had I lied to get him in, but I told them, I said, look, I'm a former Washington Post reporter, and I happen to know Mike Wallace of 60 Minutes, and I will call the Washington Post. I will call Mike Wallace. I will do anything I can to call attention to you turning my son loose. And within an hour, and of course, that's a journalistic violation. Journalists are not supposed to use their role in that kind of way for personal gain. And I knew that, but I felt so desperate about my son. And within an hour, the insurance company had backed off. And that night, the hospital released a young girl who's very similar to my son's age. Her parents and I had met in the waiting room. And that girl left the hospital and disappeared. And to this day, those poor parents have no idea where their daughter is. So I felt, you know, some vindication in violating my ethics.
Writer Peter Early. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining me, we're speaking with Pete Early. He's a veteran journalist who describes the painful story of his son's mental illness and his own research into our mental health system. The book is called Crazy, A Father's Search Through America's Mental Health Madness. Now, you told us earlier that your son, when he was in a delusional state, had broken into an unoccupied house and you know, vandalized it a bit and had run a bubble bath and had broken some things. After he got some treatment, he had to go to court and face the consequences of that break-in.
That's absolutely correct. I was shocked, but he was charged with two serious felony crimes. And my son at the time was in school studying for a career that requires a state license. And if you had felonies, you could not get that. And of course, as the father, I was totally outraged, saying, this is wrong. Why would you charge him with two crimes when he clearly was delusional? I was so frustrated, I couldn't sleep at night, and my wife said, look, you're a journalist, why don't you investigate this? And then I discovered that jails and prisons had really become our new asylums, that there were 300,000 people in jail today with serious, severe mental illnesses. There's 500,000 of them on probation. 16% of everyone in a jail, 16% have a mental illness. And I wanted to know why. I wanted to figure out why were we jailing people who are clearly psychotic.
And as you took on this subject, I guess what you discovered was that, you know, decades ago, those hundreds of thousands of people were in state mental hospitals, right?
Absolutely. Dave, what happened was, you know, it's come full circle. In the 1700s, the lunatics, as they were called, were all locked up in jails and prisons. And Dorothea Dix came along in the 1800s and said, look, these people need treatment. They don't need to be incarcerated. And so she literally, single-handedly, was responsible for building state hospitals. And by the 1900s, the entire country had state hospitals. Well, sadly, these things turned into really horrific places, as we all know. By the 1940s, we had series like Bedlam and Life magazine, the book Snake Pit. We had exposés where they were comparing these hospitals to concentration camps. And there were horrific things happening in them. There's no doubt about that. What happened in 1963 is Kennedy came along and he said, okay, let's build community-based treatment centers. And everybody went, yeah, that's the way to go. Let's get them out of these state hospitals. Get them out of these warehouses. But really not much happened. Then what happened was you had the civil rights attorneys come along and they started filing lawsuits against these horrific places. At about that same time, you had the development of new antipsychotic drugs. Thorazine appeared, and all of a sudden it seemed possible to actually treat people in the communities. So you had this combination of you had Thorazine, you had civil rights suits starting to come up in the 70s and the 80s, and you had more of a drive for community-based. You also had what was called the anti-psychiatry movement, where people said, hey, who's to say what's normal? And people with mental illnesses like schizophrenia, they actually just have a different way of thinking. There was no conception that this was actually a chemical problem. It was more of a choice. People were choosing to be mentally ill, to act this way. All of those things came together, but the real key I discovered during my research in deinstitutionalization was the federal government. All of a sudden, the federal government said, okay, we'll start giving these people benefits. We'll give them various kind of federal benefits. And then the state legislators looked at it and said, hey, let's push them off onto the feds. So what happened is you went from 500,000 people being in state hospitals overnight to 100,000. And they started showing up in our streets. And then they started showing up in our jails. And you can plot this out. You can see how people moved. It's called transinstitutionalization. They move from the state hospitals to the streets, then into our jails.
In addition to this movement by the federal governments and the state legislatures to move people out of these huge state hospitals into community treatment settings, you had a growth of lawyers, in effect, asserting the rights of mentally ill people to refuse treatment and making it more and more difficult for a relative or a loved one to commit someone to treatment.
That's absolutely right. What happened was you had the Mental Health Bar, a group that later became the Bazelon Center here in Washington, who in the 70s and 80s were looking at this saying, you know, these hospitals are so horrible, let's do our best just to shut them down. And the way they did that was in the courts. And the key ruling in all of this, one of the key rulings, well, the first one was the Supreme Court's decision that you can't arrest someone just because they're mentally ill. The second key ruling was that commitment procedures had to have the same kind of legal protections as a criminal case. And so that took it out of the world of the doctors and the parents and the loved ones and put it into the world of a criminal type trial. So even if you have a situation where the judge and the defense attorney and the person who supposedly is trying to get this person into treatment, oftentimes are the prosecutors, even though all of them may agree that this person is clearly psychotic and not thinking clearly, the law says they have to be in imminent danger. And so the civil rights attorney will say, I'm sorry, I know the person is psychotic, but we got to turn them loose. That is the law.
Writer Pete Early. His latest book is Crazy, A Father's Search Through America's Mental Health Madness. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of A Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens, available in stores and online. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, with the new website at macfound.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our interview with Pete Early, author of Crazy, A Father's Search Through America's Mental Health Madness. And we discuss ways to get treatment for those who don't believe they're sick with psychiatrist E. Fuller Torrey. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. We're speaking with journalist Pete Early, whose latest book is Crazy, A Father's Search Through America's Mental Health Madness. It's in part the story of his efforts to get his own son treated for his serious mental illness. Early came to believe that laws enacted to protect the mentally ill from abuse and unnecessary confinement have made it practically impossible to get treatment for someone like his son, who believed his medicine was poison and refused treatment. The current law essentially, it seems to require very dire circumstances before someone can be forced into treatment, imminent danger to themselves or others. Is it clear in your own mind how you can craft criteria which work better, get treatment they need, people treatment they need without trampling their rights?
Well, I come at this as a parent. And so obviously, and I also come at as a journalist who's used to exposing wrongs. I don't pretend to be the overall expert on how you could craft a law, but I think there would be a way to either reinterpret the intimate danger clause remove the intimate part, or set up some kind of tribunal panel, mental health court, some way where you had someone who was perhaps not the parent, but a parent representative, a judge, as well as a doctor. We can't just limit it to the law. That is cruel when you're dealing with someone who is not thinking clearly, who believes that everyone is out to get them, who believes their life is being threatened by doctors their own parents. I've never met anyone who has been taken off the streets who has been helped by medication. And remember, medication, while it's not the answer, helps 70% of people with mental illnesses, who has said, gee, I wish you would have left me there.
Well, Pete Early, we spoke earlier about your son's mental illness and the terrible traumas that you went through trying to get him treatment. And your book ends on a helpful note because you describe how he did get his meds, and he did get a whole lot better. And there's a wonderful lunch that the two of you share in which you're, he's talking about going back to graduate school and looking at building his future. And you're enjoying it, and yet you note that the odds are that most people in his situation will at some time go off their meds and suffer relapses. How is Mike doing?
Well, the book was finished more than a year ago. It takes that long to get it printed. And I thought everything we'd been through after 2 years of this, after all the therapy, after the courts, surviving going through the courts, after him being on probation, I thought, wow, we've learned a lesson. And what I discovered is mental illness is not a lesson to learn. Within 3 months after my son went off, was off his probation, he stopped taking his medication. That led to another harrowing 6 months where finally we were able to get him back on. And the reality is, all of us who love someone who's struggling with a mental illness, there is no end. There is no happy ending. You are always dealing with a very cruel disease that you have to be on guard about. And so it just continues on and on. Now, the biggest problem for me, to answer your question, is as a parent trying to learn when to let go, trying not to look at my son every day and say, is he on his meds? Is he off? Trying not to interfere with his life, but to let him live his own life. And that's very tough when you're dealing with someone who you know has an organic brain disease.
Well, Pete Early, thanks so much for speaking with us, and certainly wish you the best for you and your son and your family.
Thank you very much.
Writer Pete Early. His latest book is Crazy, A Father's Search Through America's Mental Health Madness. When Pete Early's son became delusional and refused to take his antipsychotic medication, Early concluded that mental health laws were preventing him and other parents from getting help for their children. The leading advocate for changing commitment laws to make it easier for courts to compel treatment for seriously disturbed patients is Dr. E. Fuller Torrey. He's a research psychiatrist specializing in schizophrenia and manic depressive illness who's written 20 books on mental illness and its treatment. He's also president of the Treatment Advocacy Center. I spoke to Dr. Torrey last week. E. Fuller Torrey, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Pete Early, in his book, described a very troubling incident he had with his son who was mentally ill, and it was an occasion relatively early in his son's mental illness at which Pete Early was driving his son back from New York. He clearly seemed to be paranoid, delusional, and he was resisting taking medications which seemed to help his mental illness. Pete Early finally gets him to an emergency room, and the doctor there asks him a few basic questions of orientation, concludes that his son is not in imminent danger to himself or anyone else, and essentially tells Pete Early, there's nothing I can do. Your son doesn't want to take his medication. I can't force him to be treated. I have to release him. And so Pete Early is left in his fury, and his son is left to go off and continue his mental illness. It's a very troubling story to hear. What can a parent do in that situation where they're in an emergency room and the doctor says, if your loved one doesn't want to be treated, there's nothing I can do?
Well, first let me say, Dave, that this is a very common scenario. The Pete Early's experience with his son is one being experienced by literally hundreds of thousands of families around the United States who have family members with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. In terms of what he could do in that situation, is the first thing he should do is to make sure he understands the laws of the state, in this case, Virginia. Does the state have what we call an outpatient commitment statute? Well, Virginia does. It's difficult to use. But the bottom line is, how do you get treatment onto an individual with a brain disease like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder? How do you get treatment when the person is not aware that they're sick, when the person is completely resistant to taking medication, even though the medication is what's going to get them well on it? So, number one, you find out what the state laws are. Secondly, you would, as Pete, I think, attempted to do, you would try and use whatever leverage you have, both with your family member and also with the treating psychiatrist in this case. And if I were in Pete Early's situation in that, I would say, I will have my lawyer contact you in the morning. If you release my son this afternoon and anything happens to him, I'm going to hold you personally responsible, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Those are all important things. And the third thing is what many of these families end up doing is using the laws to get treatment. In other words, most people like Pete Early's son end up committing a crime, usually a misdemeanor crime. In his case, it was breaking into somebody's home and taking a bath in the bathtub. But indeed, he did have charges against him. Many of the families then end up using that as the way to get leverage to insist that their family member get into a treatment system, and the alternative is going to jail. And these now exist in what we call mental health courts in many of the states, and they have grown up, again, as a way to fulfill this huge vacuum that has evolved over the last 30 years as we change the laws to make it almost impossible to treat people who need treatment but who themselves don't know that they need treatment.
Now, let me back up here. You said that a lot of states, including Virginia, have an outpatient commitment statute. What does that provide for in terms of compelling someone who needs psychiatric help to receive it?
The way it works, Dave, and we have it in the District of Columbia also, and when I was working for many years at St. Elizabeth's Hospital, I used it many times. I would go to court with someone who had, say, been admitted 20 times, and I would say to the judge, Your Honor, this fellow's been in and out of the hospital 20 times. He has no awareness of his illness. He needs to stay on medication. I would like to release him this Thursday on condition that he come back and get his injection every 3 weeks to stay on the medication. That's what's called an outpatient commitment. You're basically saying to the individual, yes, you can live in the community on the condition that you remain on your medication, and we have a way to monitor that you're remaining on your medication. 42 states have statutes like this. 8 states do not. But even in those 42 states that have them, including Virginia, it's often underutilized or particularly in some states, it is so difficult to use that many families don't use it.
It sounds, though, in a case like that Pete Early was confronted with, where his son did not have a long history of hospitalizations, but clearly was behaving in an irrational, delusional way, that it doesn't sound as if that outpatient commitment statute really would have applied to him.
If he had had no dangerousness, and certainly in Virginia I think this is true, I think that's probably true. But this is because we have changed the laws to make it very, very difficult to treat people who are mentally ill, even if they don't understand that they're mentally ill.
Dr. E. Fuller Torrey, he specializes in schizophrenia and manic depressive illness. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with psychiatrist E. Fuller Torrey. He's president of the Treatment Advocacy Center. Now, you mentioned that a lot of people who are mentally ill will end up committing a crime and thereby entering both the court system and the mental health system that way. And you indicated that if they are arrested for a misdemeanor, that often is an avenue by which a court can compel treatment rather than incarceration.
Right. That's exactly right. And these often go under mental health courts, where these are special courts set up by the state just to handle people who are mentally ill. It is so difficult to get treatment that some of the state officials will tell families, you know, the best thing that could happen to your son or daughter is to get arrested, because then we would be able to get them into a treatment program. But until they're arrested, we can't do anything. It's a really sad state of affairs when that's a situation, and that's exactly the way it is.
Now, if the arrest is for a felony, I mean, let's say you shove someone or hit someone or something that's regarded as an assault, does that disqualify you for this kind of outpatient treatment and instead relegate you to a life of being in prison?
Again, that varies by state. These are state laws, and in some states, the mental health courts will indeed include felonies, and in other cases, they will not. Clearly, if you have a felony charge against you, it's considered much more serious, and often that person will end up in the state prison system and then will be on parole when they are finally released, and the parole will effectively keep them on medication as long as they're on parole.
Do you think that going into the prison system as opposed to a compulsory outpatient treatment clinic can help people with schizophrenia, or is it almost always a bad thing?
No, I have actually seen it be a good thing, and the fact that I can say that I think is very sad. But going into the prison system in some states is the only way now you can get into, involuntarily, that you can get into a treatment program. I think it's important to emphasize that about half the people with the kind of illness that Peter Early's son had, bipolar disorder and schizophrenia, about half these people are not aware that they're sick. They have damage to the part of the brain that we use to think about ourselves, and therefore they go into the category of people like Alzheimer's disease who don't know that they're sick. But we haven't paid attention to that fact. We've just paid attention to civil liberties and saying nobody who doesn't want to be treated should be treated. And that's why we have so many people with mental illnesses in the jail and also among the homeless on the streets.
These outpatient commitment statutes are, of course, controversial. Your adversary in this debate often is the Bazelon Center for Mental Health Laws, which makes the case that these kinds of statutes represent really a dangerous coercion of the mentally ill and a violation of their rights, and that what you really need is much more extensive funding for the kind of treatment that will help, and that once you indulge society's penchant for locking people up, then you allow them to forget about it and you lose the pressure for real funding and real treatment. What about that argument?
Yes, it's very important to fund adequate services, but if you don't think you're sick, you're not going to use services no matter how adequate they are or how attractive they are, because there's no reason to. Some of my patients from St. Elizabeth are sitting a few blocks from here over in Lafayette Park today, and they really think that they're in touch with the president, and they really think the CIA is beaming messages into their head. It's important to understand that they have no awareness of their illness at all. In terms of locking people up, one of the nice things about the outpatient commitment statutes is it doesn't lock anybody up. What it does is says you can live in the community as long as you stay on your medication, and for that reason, we don't have to lock you up. And we know from the data from outpatient commitment statutes that outpatient commitment accomplishes many things. It decreases rehospitalization markedly. It decreases homelessness. It decreases the number of these people who end up in jail. And it decreases the episodes of violence. So we know it works, and we know it works by leaving people in the community. It's not necessary, in most cases, it's not necessary to lock them up.
And I guess a crucial distinction between that kind of treatment and the typical community-based treatment is that you're not simply giving the patient a bottle of pills which they are on their honor to take. They must come in and actually get regular injections of the antipsychotic drugs.
There's several ways to do it, Dave. One is you can have them come in and get their injection every 2 weeks, every 3 weeks. That works very well for some. In some cases, you can do as they do for people who have tuberculosis, who refuse to take medicine, and that is have them come to the clinic each day and take their pills in front of a public health nurse or in front of some kind of professional. In other cases, you can monitor their urine. You can do random urine checks, and there are ways to do this to make sure that they are taking the medication. So you can do it in a variety of ways, but we haven't done it very well because we haven't used this very much.
When a patient is committed by the court to one of these outpatient treatment programs that you have described, they show up regularly and get their medications under the supervision of a professional. How does the court ensure that the patient stays with the program?
Well, I can tell you how it worked here in the District of Columbia when I was working at St. Elizabeth's Hospital and used it. Is once I had the approval of the court for an outpatient commitment, I would say to the individual, usually a male, because they're much more inclined not to take medication, I would say you need to come in every 3 weeks for your injection. If you don't come in, I have the right to have a District of Columbia policeman come to your house and bring you involuntarily to the hospital where we can keep you in the hospital. You almost never have to actually do that. But the court does that's part of the outpatient commitment, is you report back to the court if the person doesn't come in, and the court can then approve a law enforcement officer going and bringing the person to the hospital. The remarkable thing is that once they're on outpatient commitment, it usually goes very smoothly. You almost never have to involuntarily hospitalize them.
Of course, these are often lifetime illnesses, and people need to remain on their meds for years and years. How long does the court supervision last in a case like this?
Court supervision will last for varying periods depending on the jurisdiction, depending on the state. 6 months is not unusual. In some cases, it will go for as long as a year. I'm not aware of anywhere it goes longer than a year on it. And in some states, it's only 90 days where you have to go back to court and get it renewed on a regular basis on it. So once the person is on it and doing well on it, then it often tends to just carry itself and will be renewed. And remarkably, many of the people, once they're on it, are quite happy to be on it because they're tired of being homeless, they're tired of being in jail, and they're tired of being victimized, as often happens when you're severely mentally ill.
There are a lot of stories of people with severe mental illness, schizophrenia, who once they are on their medications and stabilized, feel much better, begin thinking rationally, and then forget, what it felt like to be so tormented and conclude, I'm fine. I really don't need my medication. And they may dislike side effects that the medications have. What do you do? What happens in a situation like that where the court has gotten them back on their meds and gotten stable, but they conclude they just don't need them?
This is a very common story, and I think Pete Early can talk about this very articulately because that's what's happened to his son on occasion on it. First, I think we all would like to deny that we're sick. Nobody would like to have an illness like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder. These are lousy diseases on it. And when you're feeling better and on medication, it's not uncommon to say, I don't think I really need this. Let me try it without it. That happens all the time, and it's a major problem. Secondly, you mentioned side effects. Side effects is a problem. As a treating psychiatrist, my job then is to find a better medication. Still produces improvement in your symptoms, but without the side effects on it. And fortunately now we have really 8 or 10 medications for both schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. We have many more choices than we had even 10 years ago. It doesn't mean that everyone responds to these medications, but 80-85% of people will respond more or less on it. But this is an issue we have to deal with all the time with the severely mentally ill, because going off their medication is really a very, very common phenomenon.
And so what do you do then?
What I do with my patients is I try and persuade them as best I can. I try and remind them of all the terrible things that's happened when they were homeless or in jail or involved in episodes of violence or being victimized. I work with their families and with their significant others and try and persuade them and remind them of what happens when people stop taking their medication. This is a daily phenomena for, I think, all psychiatrists and psychologists who have to work with people with severe mental illnesses. You do everything you can to persuade them. Sometimes you can't persuade them. Then you have to go to legal mechanisms like outpatient commitment.
And is part of the things you tell them now, you don't want to go back before the judge, do you?
Of course, and especially if they have misdemeanor charges holding over their head, then the court still has leverage on them, and you can say, you know, if you don't stay on your medication, then the judge can send you to jail. That's pretty good leverage, and that's sometimes the only leverage you have. So you use whatever persuasion, coercion, blackmail that you can to try and keep people on the medicine and to keep them well so that they can lead a reasonably normal life.
Psychiatrist E. Fuller Torrey. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Dr. E. Fuller Torrey. He's a psychiatrist and president of the Treatment Advocacy Center, which seeks changes in the nation's mental health commitment laws. Many of the hundreds of thousands of people who are mentally ill in communities and on the street today, two or three generations ago, would have been in state hospitals, you know, which were, you know, renowned for abuses. What do you think? Should we have more state hospitals than we do, or was it the right thing to close them?
Well, I would, first of all, let me say that 95% of the people who would have been hospitalized 50 years ago are not hospitalized now. Less than 5% of the people, proportion of population, are now in equivalent of state hospitals. So it's a very, very small group. No, we need a few more beds, but most of the people living in the community can live in the community. And in fact, living in the community is preferable to living in a state hospital in almost every case, as long as you stay on your medication. But if you are living in the community without medication and you are homeless, and as a study in Los Angeles, 28% of the homeless severely mentally ill get the majority of their food from garbage cans, this is not exactly a quality life. If, on the other hand, you are in jail and in prison because of your severe mental illness, this is not a quality life either. So that I would say of all the people that we have emptied out, we deinstitutionalized from the hospitals, we've emptied out the hospitals, I'd say about half of them are better off living in the community, but a half are not better off. They're the ones who are roughly 150,000 severely mentally ill among the homeless, roughly 200,000 severely mentally ill now in jails and prisons. This is not a great way to live.
And apart from more effective commitment laws, what should the national priorities be that will help those people?
I think the commitment laws are extremely important. Good services are extremely important. The way we have organized our services and funded our services is really chaotic. Much of the managed care has been very detrimental to people with severe mental illnesses, especially the for-profit managed care. We've really done a terrible job of taking care of these people once they're out of the hospital. The only thing we were good at was emptying the hospitals. Everything that came after that has really been a disgrace.
It's a big question, but do you need a national health insurance program to ensure that mentally ill people get the treatment they need?
Well, most of the severely mentally ill don't qualify for most of the insurance programs we have. And in fact, in a sense, Medicaid to a lesser extent, Medicare. Medicaid is the national health insurance for people with severe mental illnesses. Medicaid is funding more than half, probably well more than half now, of the services for severely mentally ill people in the United States. And it's not really just a question of money. One of the things that we have found over the years is states that are spending more money do not necessarily have better services. It's how they organize their services. And we know how to organize the services. It's just the way the funding system is set up that we don't do it. But it all goes back to the beginning. If you don't have laws that allow you to treat people who need to be treated, then no matter how good your services are, it's not going to work.
Well, E. Fuller Torrey, thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure, Dave. Thank you.
Dr. E. Fuller Torrey. His book, Surviving Schizophrenia, is now in its fourth edition. You can get more information about the Treatment Advocacy Center at its website, psychlaws.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menhivar. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from TIAA CREF, serving the financial needs of those in the academic, medical, cultural, and research fields. Online at TIAACREF.org/greater good. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art and its current exhibition of paintings by Edvard Munch, MOMA.org. And from the Gruber Family Foundation for support of NPR's international coverage. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actress Catherine Keener. She co-starred in The 40-Year-Old Virgin and got a second Oscar nomination for her role as Harper Lee in Capote. Now she's in a new film called Friends with Money. I'm Dave Davies. Join us for the next Fresh Air.